Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program number 292, titled Power Corrupts. The title, of course, is taken from the famous phrase, Power Corrupts and Absolute Power Corrupts Absolutely. We've been looking at the California and national, quote, energy crises, unquote. And in particular, in Side 1, we took a look at George Bush's partiality to the coal industry and a ludicrous and nonetheless very alarming, because the Bush took it seriously, projection by a coal industry lobbying organization that the increased production of carbon dioxide would be good for the environment, and that we needed it because the internet was resulting in the electricity shortage, and that we needed to buy more to build more coal-fired power plants. The ludicrousness of the Bush slash coal industry analysis was detailed in Side 1 of For the Record Program number 292. And what we're going to do is to continue with a revisiting, albeit brief, of a remarkable article published in El Andar magazine. That's capital E-L, capital A-N-D-A-R magazine. This is from El Andar's issue of the fall of 2000, volume 11, number 3. This article, which in my opinion should have gotten a Pulitzer Prize, was authored by Julie Reynolds, and assistance on the research was by Victor Almazan and Anya Leonor Rojo. The website for El Andar magazine is www.elandar.com, and I strongly encourage people to check this article out. The article is titled Los Amigos de Bush, subtitled The Shady Ties of George W. Bush's Latino Friends, and we were looking at an individual named Ernesto Ancira Jr., who has more connections than a switchboard, very close to George Bush. His cousins are deeply involved with the Mexican energy industry. Ancira's circle of associations also deeply involved with the drug trade, as we will see. We were talking about Ancira's Mexican relatives, their involvement in the energy trade, and also the apparent involvement of some of the companies that they were involved in as fronts for the drug trade. We're going to resume with this article. Soon, speaking of the A-Kids, the Ancira family, soon their companies were accused of being fronts for the drug trade and were described as such by analyst R.C. Whalen at a 1993 U.S. congressional hearing. Together with a secretive binational strip mining operation called Dos Repúblicas, the Ancira's tried to get a Tex-Mex energy deal going by revamping a decrepit, coal-burning power plant on the border named Carbon 2. They convinced the World Bank, Citibank, and Southern California Edison, I would note parenthetically now bankrupt, to invest over $250 million in the project. It was a disaster. The Ancira's reputation sank as fast as a rust-eaten bucket, and partners and investors began to look for ways out. The Ancira family was accused by shareholders of wasting extraordinary amounts of money on corporate jets, limousines, and other luxuries, not to mention their extensive purchases of San Antonio real estate. Just last year, while the company amassed nearly $2 billion in debt and had to suspend payments, the Ancira's began quietly moving property titles to Cayman Island holding companies with the help of their frontman, Marcelo Sanchez. Carbon 2 should have been the kind of project Governor Bush would have embraced, a model energy venture between Mexico and the U.S. But as environmentalists' complaints about air pollution grew louder, Bush's comments grew guarded. By the time of the project's final demise in 1995 due to mismanagement, as well as the fact that its approval by Salinas had been blatantly illegal, Bush was given credit for heeding environmental concerns. So again, from that article, something of a foreshadowing of Bush's attitude towards coal-burning power plants, and also yet another clue to some of the associations of the Bush family. What we're going to do now is to jump from the past to the future, and we're going to take a look at some developments which are looming large on the future of the American electrical generation, or the American electricity industry, the American power generating industry. The second largest electricity generator in the world is now a German company called EON, spelled capital E-O-N. It is the second largest utility in Germany and the second largest power generating company in the world. They are now engaged in corporate maneuvering to prepare themselves for a large entry into the United States power generating market. And we're going to take a look at EON, some of its history, and we're going to take a look at this company because they are now projecting a big move into the American power generating market. Again, they're the second largest electricity company in the world at this point, and with the American power market wide open under George Bush, and with California's utilities now bankrupt, it'll be interesting to see whether or not EON makes the move into California, and it certainly is going to be making moves into the United States. We're going to take a look at EON now in the Financial Times of Tuesday, April 10th of the year 2001. This is an article by Uta Harnischweger in Dusseldorf. It's headlined, Power Gen is a Stepping Stone, subtitled, EON Bid is a Step to Acquiring Skills Necessary to Cross the Atlantic and Achieve Growth. This article reads in part as follows. Britain's second-largest power generator yesterday became a mere stepping stone in the global ambitions of one of Europe's biggest utilities. E.ON, Germany's second-largest utility, finally launched its long-awaited 15.3 billion euro or $13.5 billion bid for PowerGen, calling it the first stage in its drive to become one of the largest power companies in the United States. Quote, "We are now getting ready for a double jump across the English Channel and, from there, across the Atlantic Ocean," unquote, said Ulrich Hartmann, chief executive. Skipping down, EON decided to spare no cost and face severe U.S. regulatory scrutiny to set up its first power base in the U.S. PowerGen, which recently purchased LG&E, the Kentucky-based utility, offers expertise in the highly regulated and fragmented U.S. market. EON gains access to PowerGen's experience with the fully liberalized U.K. electricity market. By the way, that's Louisville Gas and Electric. More about EON and its move into the United States. We're going to take a look now at the very differing effects of deregulation on the power industry in the United Kingdom and in Germany. In the United Kingdom, it resulted in the divestiture of corporate assets, the opposite in Germany. We're going to turn now to the Financial Times of Wednesday, April 11th of the year 2001. An editorial titled Bad Connection reads in part as follows. In the UK, the dominant generating companies were forced to divest in order to promote competition. So in spite of PowerGen's acquisition of LG&E of Kentucky, it is a relatively small power company in international terms, with only about 8% of the UK market. In Germany, by contrast, deregulation has allowed consolidation of the regional monopolies into two main groups, E.ON and RWE. E.ON, formed from Viba and Viag, is now set to become the second largest electricity company in the world after Électricité de France. It plans to become bigger still by making U.S. acquisitions, and it remains to be seen just what E.ON winds up acquiring in the United States. We're going to take a look now at the Financial Times of Tuesday, April 10th of the year 2001, and we're going to take a look at some of the corporate adjusting that is being made by E.ON. Again, assuming the PowerGen deal is completed, and it appears that it will be. By the way, note that that PowerGen acquisition gives E.ON a foothold in the United States through PowerGen's acquisition of LG&E. We're going to take a look now at some of the corporate maneuvering and the divestiture that E.ON has engaged in, and in particular, we're going to take a look at a very familiar, and to any student of the Third Reich and World War II, very ominous name that is one of the corporate properties of E.ON that is now being spun off. This again is from the Financial Times of Tuesday, April 10th of the year 2001. This article is by Andrew Taylor in London and Uta Harnischweger in Frankfurt. It's headlined, E.ON to sell off assets to smooth deal on PowerGen. The article reads in part as follows. E.ON, the German utility, pledged to sell its Degussa chemical division yesterday after agreeing to buy PowerGen, the British electricity group, in a deal worth 9.6 billion euro, or $13.8 billion. Degussa, by the way, capital D-E-G-U-S-S-A, and we're going to come back to that. U.S. regulations bar groups that generate less than 80% of their sales from electricity and gas supply from owning U.S. energy companies. To comply with the regulations, E.ON will also sell its real estate activities. Chemical operations contributed 22% of E.ON's sales last year. The prospect of large disposals prompted a rise of more than 5% in the shares to 54.45 euros. PowerGen's shares rose 13.5 pence to 719.5. Quote, the acquisition of PowerGen, or actually there's no quote there, the acquisition of PowerGen will make E.ON the world's largest power supplier behind Électricité de France, the state-owned power group, which would be 30% bigger. The acquisition will give E.ON footholds in both the UK and U.S. energy markets. Ulrich Hartmann, E.ON's chairman, said, quote, we have had very constructive talks with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, and they will grant us 3 to 5 years after the closing of the deal to get these things done, unquote. Industrial activities such as Stinnis, a logistics unit, or VAW Aluminum have been earmarked for sale next year when German capital gains tax on corporate disposals is due to be abolished. By the way, the Stinnis firm was heavily involved with the Third Reich, very close to the Dulles family, and we discussed the Dulles family, their relationship to the Bushes, and to Ibn Saud, the founder of the Saudi Arabian nation, and an individual who in turn was very close to Osama bin Laden's father, and one of Osama bin and the bin Laden family appears to have put up part of the capital that went to finance George W.'s first energy company, Arbusto Energy. Continuing now with this discussion. A formal offer will not be launched until regulatory hurdles have been cleared. Skipping down. PowerGen is Britain's second largest generator with a 10% market share. It retails electricity and gas to more than 3 million UK customers. Last year, it bought LG&E, the Kentucky-based energy group, in a deal worth £3.6 billion. E.ON, formed in 1999 by the merger of German utilities Weber and Viag, was advised by Goldman and Sachs, as well as Dresdner Kleinwort Wasserstein, UBS Warburg, and N.M. Rothschild. So again, note that the... E.ON company, formed by the merger of two of Germany's largest utilities, has now gained a foothold in the United States, and note that they are engaging in divestiture, including the Stinnis firm, and, for our purposes here, very significantly and ominously, Degussa. We've taken a look at the Degussa firm in the past. In For the Record program number 87, we took a look at Degussa's involvement with the Third Reich, and also their role in helping to arm Saddam Hussein. Degussa is one of many German and U.S. corporations that is the defendant in a class action suit by veterans of the Gulf War suffering from Gulf War syndrome. They're suing Degussa, among other firms, for helping to give Saddam Hussein his CBW capabilities. We're going to take a look now at the Degussa firm's history, and again, it is a very ominous history indeed. We're going to turn now to a book called The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben, authored by Joseph Borken. Joseph Borken worked for the Antitrust Division, the Economic Warfare Section of the Antitrust Division of the Department of Justice in World War II. This book, of course, is about I.G. Farben, the German chemical cartel. Borken's The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben was published in hardcover in 1978 by the Free Press, a division of Macmillan. The hardcover ISBN number 0-02-904630-0. Now, the Degussa firm was a third owned by I.G. Farben. A third ownership will give a company effective control unless somebody else owns two-thirds. And I would note that the one-third owned one-third IG-owned Degussa company, along with IG Farben proper, were the companies that owned the Degesh subsidiary. That was D, that's spelled D-E-G-E-S-C-H. And Degesh is the company that manufactured the Zyklon B for the gas chambers in World War II. We're going to read about this. The Hess referred to here, H-O-E-S-S, is Rudolf Hess, the commandant of the Auschwitz death camp in World War II. In August 1941, using 500 Russian prisoners of war as an experimental group, Hess introduced into the airtight chambers of Birkenau a new asphyxiating agent, Zyklon B. Actually, Zyklon B, whose generic name is prussic acid, was new only in its application to human beings. Its traditional commercial use was as an insecticide. The result was a revelation of efficiency. Only one firm, the German Corporation for Pest Control, known in the trade as Degesh, D-E-G-E-S-C-H, supplied this lethal chemical. That firm and its most valuable asset, the monopoly of Zyklon B manufacture, was owned 42.5% by IG Farben Industry, 42.5% by Deutsche Gold and Silberscheidenstalt, known as Degussa, D-E-G-U-S-S-A, in which IG owned a third, and 15% by the Theo Goldschmidt concern. That IG-dominated Degesh was general knowledge in the chemical industry. In fact, in its official corporate pronouncements, Degesh described itself as an exclusive selling agent for IG. Moreover, IG dominated the Degesh supervisory board. Of its 11 members, 5 were from IG, including the chairman, Wilhelm Mann. Skipping down, in the past, the SS had bought moderate amounts of Zyklon B from Degesh as a vermin control in its concentration camps. When the final solution added Jews to the SS extermination plans, Degesh profits reflected the new prosperity. IG's dividends on its Degesh investment for the years 1942, 3, and 4 were double those of 1940 and 1941. And again, note who owned the Degesh subsidiary that manufactured Zyklon B. Repeating a last sentence, the firm and its most valuable asset, the monopoly of Zyklon B manufacture, was owned 42% by IG Farben Industry, 42.5% by Degussa, and 15% by the Theo Goldschmidt concern. And note in the April 10th, 2001 Financial Times article that we excerpted in discussing the divestiture by E.ON, the lead paragraph reads, E.ON, the German utility, pledged to sell its Degussa chemical division yesterday after agreeing to buy PowerGen, the British electricity group, in a deal worth £9.6 billion, or $13.8 billion. And skipping down, chemical operations contributed 22% of E.ON's sales last year. U.S. regulations bar groups that generate less than 80% of their sales from electricity and gas supply from owning U.S. energy companies. So again, the divestiture by E.ON of Degussa would appear to be, and in fact certainly is, in anticipation of their moving into the U.S. regulatory market, and that will be very interesting indeed. We're going to take a look now at a discussion of IG Farben's role in the remarkable and deadly Bormann Flight Capital Organization. I've spoken about that many times. It is literally the economic and political component of a Third Reich gone underground. We're going to rely once again for our discussion on the definitive book about the Bormann Organization. That book is called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, authored by Paul Manning, M-A-N-N-I-N-G. Paul Manning was part of the CBS News team that covered the war in Europe under Edward R. Murrow. He trained as a gunner on a B-17 to cover the air raids into Europe, was credited with shooting down an ME-109, and then broadcast the surrender of Germany on the CBS radio network. He then trained as a gunner on a B-29 in order to cover the air raids into Japan, and then broadcast the surrender of Japan on the CBS radio network as well. He researched the Bormann Organization in his post-war career, several major contracts with several book contracts with major publishing companies were canceled due to pressure by the Borman organization. Ultimately, Lyle Stewart, whose company published Martin Borman, Nazi in Exile in hardcover, copyright 1981, had both of his legs broken the week of publication, and in 1993, Paul Manning's son Jerry was murdered as part of the retribution for Manning's work on the Borman organization. The dedication of the book is to his wife Peg and to their four sons, Peter, Paul, Gerald, and John. Gerald, of course, was murdered. Of I.G. Farben's role in the Borman Flight Capital Organization and in turn of the powerful corporate connections of I.G. Farben abroad, including and especially to the United States, we read as follows in Martin Borman, Nazi in Exile. Powerful friends of the Borman organization in all Western countries, including those sprinkled in control points throughout the administration in Washington and in the financial and brokerage businesses of Wall Street, the City of London, and the Paris establishment, did not wish a coordinated drive to get at these external German assets. They had understandable reasons if you overlook morality. The financial benefits for cooperation, collaboration had become an old hat term with the war winding down, were very enticing, depending on one's importance and ability to be of service to the organization and the 750 corporate fronts in neutral countries that they were secretly manipulating, to say nothing of the known multinationals such as I.G. Farben, Thiessen AG, and Siemens, and as a second reason, the philosophy of free enterprise and preservation of private property. Skipping down of Hermann Schmitz, the head of I.G. Farben and his relationship to both Martin Borman and I.G.'s role in the Borman Flight Capital Organization, we read as follows. In testimony later given to Nuremberg investigators, Schmitz praised Borman for the way he had directed the distribution of German assets around the world. His own Farben organization had, of course, contributed to the success of the operation. Every regional representative working for Hermann Schmitz was an exceptional businessman, or he would not have been with IG. All had contributed sound advice in their areas of competence. The regions of the world where they represented Farben while keeping an eye on the subsidiaries of the parent concern and the 700 hidden corporations they controlled. They had provided assistance and continuing guidance to, they had provided assistance and continuing guidance in establishing the 750 new companies created on order of Borman, who wanted more than hidden assets. Borman wanted the money and patents and technicians put to work to create even greater assets that would bolster Germany in the post-war years. In their meeting in the Chancellery, both men checked over the figures of sums disbursed, and they were accurate to the Pfennig. The Reichsleiter, that's Borman, asked Schmitz his view of the future. Schmitz replied, quote, "The occupation armies will be understanding in the West, but certainly not in the East. I have instructed all Farben administrators and technicians to come to the West where they can be of use in resuming our operations once the disturbances of 1945 come to a halt," unquote. By the way, a major IG asset in the East was the Leuna refinery that we spoke about in connection with the CDU funding scandal in For the Record programs 193, 276, and 278. Continuing, Schmitz added that while general bomb damage to the IG plants was about 25% of capacity, some were untouched. He mentioned speaking with Field Marshal Model, who was commanding the defenses of the Ruhr. Quote, "Model had planned to turn our Bayer Leverkusen pharmaceutical factory into an artillery base, but he agreed to make it an open, undefended factory. Hopefully, we will get it back untouched," unquote. What about your board of directors and the essential executives? If they are held by the occupation authorities, can IG continue, Borman asked? We can continue. We have an operational plan for such a contingency which everyone understands. However, I don't believe our board members will be detained too long, nor will I. But we must go through a procedure of investigation before release, so I have been told by our NW7 people who have excellent contacts in Washington. Some of the IG Farben executives, including Hermann Schmitz, got relative wrist slaps. Schmitz spent 4 years and was sentenced to 4 years in jail, but they lived very comfortably, and many of them had their sentences commuted. Most of the second tier of executives received no punishment at all. Skipping down to discussion of IG Farben's role in manufacturing the poison gas, Zyklon B, and the post-war dispersal of corporate assets, that obviously would include Degussa, which was part of E.ON, as we just saw, returning once again to Martin Bormann, Nazi in exile. Schmitz also told Bormann of his visit to Switzerland earlier in the month. Quote, "Germany will have a poor image problem this time, much worse than after the First World War. It can all be placed on the doorsteps of Goering, Himmler, and Heydrich. Goering and Himmler thought up the final solution for the Jews, and Heydrich made it a fact." Bormann agreed, asking, "How does that affect IG?" "We produce the poison gas on Himmler's orders," Schmitz explained, "so I've been making some corporate name changes in Basel, which may help our overseas situation." And indeed, it did. As to the Bormann organization's post-war assimilation with the IG, the post-war IG companies, and in particular about the role of the Bormann organization through the Hermann Schmitz Trust with Standard Oil of New Jersey, returning once again to the subject of the American energy industry, we read in Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. "The Bormann organization continues to wield enormous economic influence. Wealth continues to flow into the treasuries of its corporate entities in South America, the United States, and Europe. Vastly diversified, it is said to be the largest landowner in South America, and through stockholdings controls German heavy industry and the trust established by the late Hermann Schmitz, former president of IG Farben, who held as much stock in Standard Oil of New Jersey as did the Rockefellers." And again, note that the Bormann Group controls German heavy industry. That would include the now-merged E.ON company, which has just divested itself of Degussa, one of the two companies that helped to manufacture Zyklon B. Degussa, basically part of the IG complex. It'll be interesting to see whether E.ON winds up, or what companies E.ON winds up acquiring in the United States. It'll be interesting to see whether the now bankrupt PG&E and or Southern California Edison wind up being acquired by E.ON. Who knows, if they wind up getting involved with PG&E, the gas in Pacific Gas and Electric could wind up being Zyklon B. "I've alluded to various tapes that are available from a tape duplication service called Spitfire." That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They're located at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. The email address is mail@spitfirelist.com. By the time you hear this program on the various stations that carry it, there will be a detailed and annotated description of For the Record program number 292 in the For the Record section of the Real Audio Equipped Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. Sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey is now archiving the For the Record segments on Real Audio. Their web address is wfmu.org/Dave Emory, DaveEmory, one word. They're also archiving longer For the Record programs, For the Record programs on a related website. That web address is http://archive.wfmu.org/archive/D-X/. And so you can access those For the Record programs on that web address. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 292, Power Corrupts. More on the California and national, quote, energy crises. This is being recorded on April 15th of the year 2001. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.